Welcome to Simpler One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simpler Living Works. This is Simpler Living Works episode 109 with my guest Richard Heinberg of the Post Carbon Institute. After the conversation in this episode, I'll report on some changes in our services. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. Richard Heinberg is the author of 13 books, including some of the seminal works on society's current energy and environmental sustainability crisis. Most recently, Our Renewable Future, Laying the Path for 100% Clean Energy, and the well-known The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. He is senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, which is leading the transition to a more resilient, equitable, and sustainable world. He is regarded as one of the world's foremost advocates for a shift away from our current reliance on fossil fuels. He has authored scores of essays and articles that have appeared in such journals as Nature, Reuters, Wall Street Journal, The American Prospect, Public Policy Research, Quarterly Review, Yes, and The Sun. And on websites such as resilience.org, theoildrub.com, alternet.org, projectcensor.com, and counterpunch.com. Richard has delivered hundreds of lectures on energy and climate issues to audiences in 14 countries, addressing policymakers at such levels from local city councils to members of the European Parliament. He has been quoted and interviewed countless times for print, television, and radio. Richard has appeared in many film and television documentaries, including Leonardo DiCaprio's 11th Hour. He is a recipient of the M. King Hubert Award for Excellence in Energy Education, and in 2012 was appointed to His Majesty the King of Bhutan's International Expert Working Group for the New Development Paradigm Initiative. Richard's animations have been viewed by nearly 2 million people, including 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Seconds, the winner of YouTube's Do Gooder Video of the Year Award. Here's Richard Heinberg, recently recorded. Well, Richard, you've been with the Post Carbon Institute for 20 years, and you've produced, 13 books, hundreds of articles and essays. Maybe you could give either the listener that's not familiar with Post Carbon Institute or the person who hasn't been in touch recently a little bit of background history and mission of the organization before we talk about your writings.
Sure. The Post Carbon Institute was incorporated in 2003. It's a small nonprofit think tank, and we address ourselves specifically to the issues around society moving away from fossil fuels, why that's important, what the implications are and will be, best ways to accomplish that, and so on. So it's a huge mission, actually, because fossil fuels have been really the source of wealth for industrial economies in the last couple of hundred years. They've done amazing things for us. They've sped up transportation, manufacturing. They've transformed agriculture and so on. But they've been kind of a bargain with the devil because, first of all, fossil fuels are finite in quantity. These are natural resources that we are mining from the earth and burning once and for all. And also, of course, burning fossil fuels releases carbon into the atmosphere, changing the climate and putting future generations, not only of humans, but of all other species at risk. So we see this as the biggest, most important task for humanity in the 21st century, getting off of fossil fuels. And that's what we study.
You have some very intriguing programs at the Post Carbon Institute. So tell us a little bit about your resilient communities and the website resilience.org.
pretty early on in our research, we realized that society has put off the transition away from fossil fuels far too long. And as a result of that, there are going to be unavoidable impacts from climate change, and also economic impacts as fossil fuels deplete and we're forced to use lower quality, harder to get, more expensive fossil resources. So the end result is we're most likely to see failure in a lot of human systems over the next few decades, economic systems, political, social systems. And society is going to have to change in various ways also just to accommodate these different energy sources. We built our current industrial systems to take advantage of the specific advantages of fossil fuels. And the kinds of energy sources we're going to use to replace fossil fuels, like wind and solar power, have very different characteristics. So we're going to need to redesign a lot of industrial and social systems around the qualities of those different energy sources. So all of this means that a lot of stuff that we depend on just isn't going to work very well as time goes on. And that's going to translate into, increasing frequency and severity of all sorts of crises, ecological as well as social. The best way to deal with those crises is going to be not so much at the national level, because our national level infrastructure and political systems are becoming more and more dysfunctional, and that process will continue. The best place to address these challenges will be at the local level, where we still have some social capital, the ability to talk to one another directly rather than tweeting insults at one another, and where we still have the capacity to access local resources, build local food systems, local economies. We see the transition to localism as being really key to success in the 21st century. If the 20th century was all about globalization, using ever high chains made possible by transport fuels, liquid transport fuels, the 21st century is going to be about relocalization of the economy and also political and social systems. We see this as being more or less inevitable because of the nature of the energy transition itself, but also desirable because globalization was really another bargain with the devil. We were able to create economic efficiencies by using the world's cheapest labor, the world's cheapest and most abundant resources wherever they were, and to connect them all via long transport networks. But by doing so, we lost local skills, we lost the viability of local economies, and people have been miserable as a result. We're depending on a culture that's a culture of sameness. Wherever you go in a shopping mall, it basically looks the same, whether it's in San Antonio, Texas, or Seattle, Washington, or Bangor, Maine. Once you're inside the mall, it's all the same chain stores and all the same products, and that creates a way of life in which it's very difficult to have engagement and pride and satisfaction. Rather than pursuing real, genuine happiness in life, we've pursued economic growth and economic efficiency above everything else. It's made us miserable, but it doesn't have to be this way. By relocalizing our economies, by making our economies more resilient to the kinds of challenges that are coming, we can actually make ourselves happier or create space for greater happiness in the midst of a very challenging world.
We know we have to make an energy transition, but we also know that probably technological fixes are not going to save us. But why can't we just shift to solar and wind and build bigger batteries?
Right. Well, there are two reasons for that. One has to do with the challenge of the energy transition itself. I worked with one of our post-carbon fellows, David Fridley, who's a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He's on their energy analysis program. We spent a year together looking at the prospects for solar and wind to replace fossil fuels and what the transition would look like in detail. The result of that is a book called Our Renewable Future, and actually you can find the whole text of the book on our website, ourrenewablefuture.org. But what we found is that, first of all, there are going to be challenges in the transition resulting just from the intermittency of solar and wind. As you say, yeah, we can build more batteries, but that's very expensive. It adds to the energy cost as well as the dollar cost of integrated energy systems. Another thing we can do is to build redundant capacity. You know, the sun isn't always shining, the wind isn't always blowing in one place, but maybe it is someplace else. So we just build more solar and wind capacity than we need, maybe by a factor of two or three, and then we can ship the power long distance over more robust electricity grids. Or a third possibility is we could change how we use energy instead of just, you know, flipping on the light switch whenever we want to use energy. We could change our habits. You know, we could have washers and dryers that we that are pre-programmed to only come on when there's lots of solar and wind electricity available. So, you know, you put the clothes in the washing machine and flip the switch, but the machine doesn't actually turn on until there's power available. You know, that kind of thing. Demand adaptation, that whole strategy is basically called. All of those things have a cost, and that cost ultimately is going to be pretty substantial as solar and wind become really major players within the overall energy spectrum. So for that reason, I don't think we can expect that the world is going to work exactly the same way after the energy transition as it does now. But there's another factor, the second thing I was going to bring up, which is that it's not all about climate change. We also face some other pretty daunting environmental problems having to do with resource depletion, pollution issues, with population growth. We're adding over 80 million new humans on a net basis every year, an extra billion humans on the planet about every 12 years, and disappearing habitat for other species. The rate of extinction of species right now is about 1,000 times the ordinary background rate. There's no way to deal with all of these problems just by installing solar panels and wind turbines. The only way we can make society actually sustainable is to rein in some of the basic tendencies of our current industrial civilization around growth of population, growth in per capita consumption, growth of the financial system, and so on. We need basically to redesign our society so that it operates within the bounds of what nature provides without, you know, borrowing from future generations, which is what we're doing now. So that in itself means, you know, big changes to how we do all kinds of things, from agriculture to transportation to manufacturing and so on. All of that together, you know, if you look at the energy transition and the nature of our future energy sources, if you look at the future of Earth in terms of biodiversity and pollution issues and so on, the only way we're going to make it through this bottleneck is by fundamentally changing how we operate on this planet.
Well, I'm really glad you brought up the issue of overpopulation, Richard, because that seems to be an issue that very few people want to talk about or touch, whether they be even activists or politicians, because we're told that we need more and more bodies to run our growth economics, you know, in the future. Since this is a difficult subject, and even population organizations only want to talk about education, or church groups only want to talk about maternal health, when the greatest form of maternal health is to have fewer babies. And so how are we going to approach this difficult topic of controlling our population? We have, you know, 9 billion people, and I've been told, and I believe, the optimal number for the Earth to sustain is 1 billion people. In fact, if we don't cut back, then we will have a smaller population, not by choice, but by necessity, within 100 years.
Right. I agree with what you said. We have our current population is about 7.6 billion. And as I said a moment ago, we're adding over 80 million a year. So that's the population of Los Angeles, New York, London, Tokyo, all added together, plus some. And somehow we have to find places and food and all the rest for all of these additional people when we're already sort of straining at the gates to provide for the people we already have. So how do we deal with this? Some of the best work I've seen is being done by an organization called Population Media Center, which is run by Bill Ryerson, who I'm proud to say is one of our post-carbon fellows. The Population Media Center operates in countries that have very high population growth rates. And what it does is to hire local creative artists to collaborate in producing usually radio, but sometimes TV soap operas that run for months and years. And in the stories of the characters within the soap operas, issues around women's decision-making power within the family, questions around how many children to have, questions around, you know, what are the consequences of having more children, how to have a smaller family size, questions around contraception are dealt with by the characters and discussed, and the implications in their lives are sort of teased out. And what this does is change cultural attitudes among the people who are listening to these radio soap operas day after day. And this has been shown to be the most effective and cost-effective way of intervening in population growth rates in these countries, which will otherwise, you know, face daunting economic and humanitarian problems as time goes on. I mean, if you have a country with, let's say, a 2% population growth rate, that means the population is going to double every 35 years. You can imagine in poor countries the humanitarian impact of just that trend. So what Bill Ryerson and Population Media Center are doing, I think, is some of the most important humanitarian work that's taking place on the planet.
That's very encouraging, Richard. Do you see any evidence that programs of giving free contraception to women are going to expand. I know there are small programs through nonprofits and through United Nations. Do you see any evidence that that's going to expand?
Right now, I think there's not enough of a trend in that direction. The best work is still being done by fairly small organizations. The UN does operate some programs on family planning, but we're going to have to change cultural attitudes in order to really come to grips with this. Cultural attitudes, not only religious attitudes about family size and contraception, but also attitudes of economists and politicians who, as you said earlier, often see population growth as a solution to economic growth, or as a source of economic growth. And that kind of misconception really has to be dealt with in order for us to turn the corner on this issue.
Well, I was encouraged that Pope Francis came out recently and hinted that having a big family was not a big deal anymore.
Good for him.
Post Carbon Institute is not an activist organization in the sense that it organizes rallies and those kinds of things. But its Speakers Bureau is very deep. Tell us about the Speakers Bureau and other way that you're reaching out through your publications and printed and electronic resources, your videos.
Well, as I said earlier, Post Carbon Institute is a very small organization. We have a small staff, about 8 people. But we have a fellows program with 30 fellows who come from various backgrounds with expertise in everything from agriculture to economic equity to in various energy issues, the built environment, city planning, so on and so on and so on. Take a while to describe all of them. But all of these experts understand and agree that the energy transition is really the biggest issue facing our society. That getting through the transition away from fossil fuels is going to have impact in every human field. And so these fellows are basically, they are our Speakers Bureau, and they also have contributed to a couple of books that we have published. One is called The Post-Carbon Reader, and the other is The Community Resilience Reader, and these books are both compendia of related essays that paint a picture of the transition ahead of us. And these books are being used by a lot of college classes on sustainability and related issues. Individual chapters of these books are available online, you look on our website, postcarbon.org, and you can find out about them and also about our fellows and our Speakers Bureau.
Well, let's take some time to talk more about you, Richard, because I think you're probably best known for your book, The End of Growth. But you've written a number of other influential books. Quite recently, Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels, and Our Renewable Future, Laying the Path for 100% Clean Energy. So so inspiring to read your books. And you also have, in addition to blogs on the Post Carbon Institute site, you have your own blog, which you call the Muse Letter. So tell us more about your publications and maybe some secrets of things that you have going on for the near future.
Right. Well, when I was young, I did not prepare myself for a career as a blogger on energy and the environment. I thought I was going to be a musician or something like that, and actually spent a number of years as a professional musician. But as these issues grew to capture more and more of my thinking and imagination, I started writing essays just as a way of sort of processing it, the information for myself and sharing my ideas with the people around me. And that became what I called the Muse Letter, which has been in publication now since January 1992. And at first it was just a little Xeroxed essay once a month that I sent around in, you know, stuffing envelopes and putting on postage stamps. And of course now it's available free online at richardheinberg.com. But then I started writing books on related subjects, on fossil fuel depletion, on, as you mentioned, the end of growth, the implication of, you know, the limits to growth scenario studies of the early 1970s are now culminating in, you know, everything that they said was going to happen is basically unfolding in front of our eyes. So what does that look like? What does it mean? And so I published several books of collections of essays, again, on related topics. So what can I say? I guess this is just a kind of an ongoing quest to try to make some sense of what is actually an overwhelming human transformation. You know, we're all living within a society that is changing and transforming under and around us. And I think it's really important to try to make sense of that, because this is an unprecedented historical moment. Either we make this shift successfully and consciously and deliberately, or it's going to be another one of those historic eras, like the fall of the Roman Empire, the fall of the Mayan civilization, where things come apart, most of the population perishes, and the ecological consequences are devastating for future generations and most of the rest of nature. This has happened before on a smaller scale. We've had about 24 civilizations in human history. And up to this time, each of them has collapsed. And often for similar reasons, resource depletion leading to a weakening of economics, which then makes societies vulnerable to outside takeover or to natural disasters of various kinds. We're following essentially down the same path, but on steroids. Because we've had fossil fuels, we've been able to build our civilization to a higher pinnacle of power and integration than ever before. A bigger civilization, controlling more of the natural world with a much higher population. So we have much further to fall. That makes it even more important that we understand what we're doing and shift our priorities, shift our behavior so that, yes, it's true, we're not going to be able to sustain the kind of civilization we currently have, but how is it going to transform? Is it just going to be collapse into oblivion, or can we surf this wave? Can we redesign civilization so that we come out the other side with something that actually still works, with people happy, with nature still surviving?
Well, thank you for that, Richard. I'd like to end our conversation, and I don't mean this to sound, you know, smart alecky. Some people may think of the old expression, you know, Nero fiddled while Rome burned. But on the other hand, You know, I have read that your 2 hours of violin practice a day is sometimes the highlight of your day, and that you do encourage the arts. So I'm not trying to put a smiley face on our predicament, but maybe you could just give us a quick coda as far as the importance of the arts in our current situation.
Right. Well, you know, we human beings are complicated critters, and we can be really ornery and selfish, but we can also create wondrous beauty. And, you know, with civilization has come both extreme destruction of the natural world and also creations of really remarkable charm. And I would hate to see our accomplishments, you know, whether it's Beethoven's symphonies or Raymond Chandler's novels or, you know, whatever your thing is, I would hate to see all of that lost to future generations. And I think we're only going to be able to preserve these genuine accomplishments, whether it's in art or music or architecture or whatever, by conserving the skills needed to recreate them and to enjoy them. So I think the arts are actually, you know, really important to human culture. Why have we done all of this if not to build something of lasting beauty? And so I don't begrudge myself the 2 hours a day of playing the violin, and like you said, they are the happiest, some of the happiest moments of my days. So I can only encourage folks to participate in the arts at whatever level, and make sure that the next generation has the basis for appreciating and continuing them.
It's important that we come to grips with the fact that our politicians, you know, from both the major parties, you know, still cannot let go of the whole idea of growth economics. And so I know that the Carbon Institute is not a political or activist organization, but are there things that you would encourage us to do to guide this this relentless pursuit of growth economics?
Well, once again, I think the best we can do with regard to getting off of growth is concentrate at the local level. You know, our main economic institution these days is the corporation. And the way corporations are set up, they basically grow or die. But that's not the only way to set up an economy. Cooperatives, worker-owned and worker-run businesses, can have very different priorities. They're not required to grow in order to survive. They can have you know, producing quality products and good work experiences for employees as their top priorities, and be very successful without ever having to pursue the kind of growth mania that exists elsewhere in our economy. So promoting local worker-owned cooperatives is, I think, one of the most important things we can do to help our economy get off of growth.
Anything you would like to add, anything about the future you'd like to add before we say goodbye? About your future work, future writings, future of the Post-Carbon Institute?
One thing I might mention is that we have a program called Think Resilience, which is a series of 22 short videos. And this is the most painless and succinct way we've been able to come up with for bringing people up to speed on the intersecting crises of the 21st century and what we can do about them. And we're making these available for educational institutions, and we're hoping that there will be hundreds of college classes using these videos. And of course, they're available for also for community groups to use for discussion groups and so on. So this is one way that we think it's easy for people to find out about what's happening and begin to work together to change.
You've been listening to my conversation with Richard Heinberg of the Post Carbon Institute. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com, on our Simple Living Works Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. Also, it really helps our visibility when you give Simple Living Works a 5-star review on iTunes. I urge you to subscribe to one of Simple Living Works' free publications. Our blog is called Simpler Living Weekly Nudge. Just send the word blog to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. I welcome you to subscribe for free to today's Simpler Living Nudge. Receive a short, thought-provoking item every day by email or Twitter. Just send me an email with the subject nudge at simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. In 2018, Simple Living Works Weekly Digest has been discontinued, and the Simple Living Works podcast reduced to one episode per month, issued on the 15th. The complete Simple Living Works Monthly Digest on the Simple Living Works site will continue to feature the latest posts from colleague organizations and will be updated weekly. Simple Living Works Weekly Nudge will feature offerings from Simple Living Works. It comes to you as your free subscription to the Simple Living Works blog. Choose the options that work for you. Subscribers to the Simple Living Works podcast will receive the Common Good podcast, which I produce and co-host, on the first of the month. Likewise, subscribers to the Common Good podcast will receive Simple Living Works podcast on the 15th as a bonus. So, Simple Living Works podcast subscribers will continue to receive 2 episodes per month. This makes good sense, since the missions of both Simple Living Works and Jubilee One Earth Economics are so complementary and the two work together closely. This combined project we now call Simpler One Earth Living. Your comments on these changes are welcome. I'm lining up inspiring thinkers and activists for this year, educator and author Mark Birch, author and green financial advisor Susan Taylor, and Don Hall of Transitions US. Since I converse with many writers, you may want to read some of their books. I have strong opinions and hopefully helpful suggestions about where to get books. I hope you'll read my short article. The link is in the show notes. Time to wrap up this episode of Simpler One Earth Living. If you're new to Simple Living Works podcast and would like more basic information, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast, our weekly blog, and Daily Nudge are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news rather than the weekly blog. The e-news is now the mid-month edition of the blog. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share-Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We don't solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. As you may sense, we put a strong emphasis on social justice. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the five life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We hope our half-hour podcasts are educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simpler One Earth Living Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.